So for this last plenary, we wanted to have an opportunity where the really good words we've been hearing about vulnerability, the things that we've been absorbing, the truth we've been hearing, could be both modeled, have examples of, and us work together on what does that look like to live out as we leave from here? What does it look like to take this gospel gift of vulnerability and embody it? And when we were thinking about doing this, two of the congregations that I thought of that I asked to do this were Cornerstone United Methodist. Did I say that right? Is that your official name? Okay. Roy's Church in Naples, Florida, and Grace Fellowship Community Church. Sharon and Doug Lee, if you've met him, he's here, are pastors of that congregation in San Francisco, California. And both Sharon and Roy are really good friends. One of the biggest gifts of planning this conference really has been becoming friends with Roy. I told folks that planning this is, okay, now I'm going off into things for Roy, which I want a chance to do. So this is kind of not as related to the plenary, but just working with Roy, he really embodies what we're talking about, both as an individual and as a congregation. And I've not even been to his congregation, so I'm just, what I've heard many others say about it, meeting Danny and Sheena from his congregation, just talking to him personally, his openness to the whole person and to all that they bring is just really embodies Christ. And he's led his congregation into that. And so in a way that is really missional. And so I asked him, like, Roy, I really want you to do this. So he said, okay. He's one of our panel speakers. Sharon was my pastor. Her church planted my church. So she was my pastor and still is my pastor. I can still consider her my pastor and mentor. And just, again, another, if I think of people who embody what we've been talking about, and as we were planning, and I was thinking, like, who embodies this? What congregations embody this? Sharon would be one of those people, and Grace Fellowship would be one of those folks. And you'll get to hear more about their story, but just the different things that the Lord has led her into and how she's just consistently chosen to take on the vulnerability of the cross of Christ in the midst of that and led her congregation to do that is compelling. So that's why I asked her to do this as well. And Mark Law Branson, I'm not actually reading their bios, so if you want to get the more official background, please read those. But Mark Law Branson has also been a really good friend to Grace Fellowship, to my congregation, to me. Okay, now you should know he's a professor at Fuller, so in terms of the actual bio. And he's been pastors of different other congregations. Look at his bio, he's done a really wide range of things. He is one of the friends of my congregation that's really helped us to be missional vulnerably. So to see that the nature of mission is vulnerability. So one of the things that happened out of a conversation with him is we decided to do something called Luke 10 groups, where we basically, for an extended period of time, just experimented doing, being sent out two by two without anything. That took different forms, but this panel is not for my story. I just wanted to, his conversations with him, his writing, has really led my congregation to be more missional, but to see that in vulnerability. And he has a wide array of really good truth that he's taught that I encourage you to engage in as much as you have opportunity. So, there's my introduction. Now I'm going to go.
And Roy gets to get us started.
First, I just have to say I'm running on 4 hours of sleep. We had a Twilight Zone taxi ride last night. It involved a monkey and a monkey. 2012, I went to the church to participate with the Cornerstone Community Worship. And I went to sit in my seat, my traditional pastor seat. And at the beginning of the service, the next thing I knew, I found myself on my knees on the floor and that my back was hurting. Somebody had come up behind me and pushed me off my chair. That was in July of 2012, and just the week before was the tragedy in Aurora, Colorado, the mass shooting. And the person that was behind me, I couldn't see the person at the time because I was just trying to catch my wits, and he was yelling at me. And he was saying that he was the king now. I'm the king now. I killed the three other kings, and I'm the judge, and I'm the judge. And I turned my head, and it was Jonathan, who has been a long-time participant at Cornerstone, a Haitian gentleman, and he was flipping out. And I have to say that in that moment, that was the first time in my pastoral ministry that I was scared. Violence had been inflicted on me. Now, just prior to that, in June of that same year, we had hateful things spray painted all over our sanctuary, all the walls of our church, swastikas, end lover, terrible derogatory things, which kind of, I think, arose in the community where we were participating and inviting people to be more open and inclusive and welcoming, and that message got out somewhere and somebody didn't like it, and so they decided. That didn't scare me a bit, though, but being on the ground, having somebody push me off my chair, I was afraid. And so I stood up, and my youth director at the time, Jonathan Nash, he actually saw what happened, and he came over, and he grabbed Jonathan around the shoulder, and he walked him out of the sanctuary. And I got up off the ground, and I just kept leading worship. Most of the congregation didn't see what had happened. And so we went through the beginning parts of worship, and it came to the sermon, and I got up to preach, and there's Jonathan, who just pushed me on the ground, sitting in the front row, looking at me like this. And I made it through the sermon. Actually, we didn't get through the sermon, of course, so I had to watch it again just to see if I made any sense. All I was thinking of was, I've got to watch this guy. And Jonathan Nash, who was my youth director, was sitting right beside him. And what that led to was getting through the sermon, going to participate in the Eucharist, and I'm standing behind the table with Lisa Lefko, who's our resident deacon. And right in the middle of the liturgy, Jonathan gets up, the gentleman who pushed me on the ground, gets up and goes and stands next to me behind the table. It was an extremely uncomfortable moment. Marrow came in my mind. I mean, all these things just, and there's part of that story too that just probably in that same time that they were painting things on the side of our building and everything, I actually received two phone calls from people that told me I had spoke pretty boldly about getting rid of all the guns in the world, and had some phone calls from people saying, I need to take you out in the woods and teach you how to shoot, Pastor, and I'll show you what gun control. I mean, just it was a really, really tumultuous time of course in my life. And so there we are celebrating the Eucharist, and Jonathan's standing next to me. And after we get done with the liturgy and people are invited forward to begin to serve, Jonathan starts yelling at Lisa and I together. And so now the whole congregation is seeing this unfold before them. And he's rolling these dice, and he's throwing them on the ground. He's going, "You're going to hell!" And then he gets the dice, and he rolls it again. He goes, "You're going to hell!" And so Lisa and I grab Jonathan, and we go outside, and we have a conversation. And we share our concern about, Jonathan, we're concerned about you. And then he starts judging us. "You're going to hell!" And so he kept this kind of narrative about killing these three kings, and that he's the judge now. And so out of concern, I called the police. And the police came and picked up Jonathan. And Jonathan's been at Cornerstone for 18 years. we knew that Jonathan has struggled with mental illness. He comes in all kinds of costumes to church at various times, but he's never been violent. And so the police came, they took Jonathan away. And the next day we had staff meeting, and the conversation was, how can we protect ourselves more from people like Jonathan? And we received calls from various families in our church that they weren't going to bring their children to our church anymore, because if we have people like Jonathan there, they're afraid for their children's safety. I had people calling me saying that they would bring their guns because they have their concealed gun permit, because in this world we need to make sure that we have our protection. This was the conversation. And because I was afraid, I was participating in the politics of security. Because I was scared. And so that went on for a week or two. I kind of let Jonathan go for a week, just to kind of pray about it and figure out what I need to do. And I knew they took him somewhere. He has no family in Naples. He came to Cornerstone because we sent a team to Jason's Place, which is a home for folks that are struggling either with addictions or mental illness issues. And so I tried the next week, the second week, to try to find out where they took Jonathan, and I couldn't get any information. And I have to say that for the next 2 weeks, because Jonathan wasn't at church, they had taken him to some mental health clinic or something, that I felt comfortable when I walked into the sanctuary and I did not see Jonathan sitting there. And about the second week after this event happened, we're sitting down with staff, we're praying about it, and we realized what we were participating in, and that we have to confess that. And one of the beautiful moments in that point was, in our confession, we became aware that while we were talking about our vulnerability and feeling like we need to protect ourselves, we became very aware of the vulnerability that Jonathan faces every time he walks through the door of our church. That somebody who wrestled their whole life with mental illness, that we're the one community he comes to each and every week, and we accept him and receive him for who he is, and that we needed to rethink how we are in relationship as community together with Jonathan. And so it was like the Holy Spirit just fell on us and said, you idiots, get over yourselves. I mean, I know you're afraid, and you got to deal with that, but Jonathan's afraid too. And how can we as a community better support Jonathan and provide a safe place for Jonathan to be with us, even in the midst of his mental illness? And so the congregation came together in that and confessed our brokenness and our fear, and at the same time began to address how we would be a welcoming and hospitable place each and every moment that Jonathan walks through the doors of Cornerstone. And so Jonathan has friends at Cornerstone who are with him all the time when he's there. We actually invited some folks in to help teach us how we can identify signs so that we can make sure that Jonathan is safe within our community and work through that together. And Jonathan still comes to Cornerstone. And just from my own vulnerable place, sometimes I'm a little anxious when I see Jonathan sitting at Cornerstone. But if we're a community that defines ourselves as welcoming all people, then all people need to find a place of safety and security within our community. So.
Thanks, Roy.
Mm-hmm. I should have gone first. Sorry. Our congregation is 32 years old, we'll be 33 in November, and I think we are at our best when we allow ourselves to be beginners. And that's kind of tricky, you know, like, because there are ways that when you've been at it for a while, you've been affirmed for things are working well, you're pretty sure you're on the right track. You want to keep going with that, but it is, as we're talking about vulnerability, it really is, it really is an act of vulnerability when you say, I'm not going to be on self-preservation or maintenance mode, I'm going to allow things to begin again. And there is a season in our congregation's life when we wanted to start over. And it's not because we didn't have a really good history. We had had a really faithful founding pastor who taught our congregation well. We had good community patterns with each other. We had disciplines of coming together for midweek study. 90% of our congregation would show up on our Thursday night Bible study. These are things I talked about in the last panel I was on at EP 2005, our strenuous membership process and you know, a lot of things that helped us be who we are. But there was a way that when we studied the book of Galatians, so we preached through this book, and it's not the letter everyone warms up to, right? You know, everyone's favorite book is Philippians or Ephesians or something, but Galatians was really messing with us. I think there was a way we could see that, you know, as Paul is talking about, there's this one table, and because there's this one table, there are no insiders and outsiders, there are no ways to measure your righteousness, no ways to mark that out and have some people be in and some people be out, that we start to see we actually do have insiders and outsiders. There are ways that we have, because of the goodness and the rightness of our patterns and all the things we were really proud of, frankly. It was creating people who were in and people who were out. It was creating a kind of leadership that was more about scrutinizing each other's lives, accountability that was stifling rather than freeing. And we had to take note of that. This book, Galatians, really pointed out our sins. So we entered into this time that this season that we call Jubilee, you know, and you read about it in the Old Testament, and every, you know, people wonder if it really happened, that this stuff about the land and the slaves didn't really happen. But it's such a marvelous thing to say, you know, that we had debts with each other. We had relational debts with each other. We had ways that we were measuring each other. We had a lot of things that we needed to hold up into the light. So we declared, it's not a year of Jubilee, it's a year and a half of Jubilee. a little different. But what we did was really kind of like come back to basics. Like, what are the things that make us who we are? Was it just our disciplines and our patterns? Or was there something about worship and confession and communion and baptism that was more about God's actions among us rather than ours? And so we did have this year and a half of Jubilee, and we actually took some time to think about our worship service and how each of those acts and each of those movements is about God's initiative. And the way we started what we call this journey, we really didn't have a curriculum as much as a sense of a journey that we were on the move, was we had everyone in the congregation who wanted to stand before the congregation, just like I'm doing with you, and say, I want to be a Christian, and I want you to help me. Mm-hmm. So, in one way, we could have all said it all at once, and it might have been effective, you know, but we had one by one, everybody go up and say that to the whole congregation, starting with me, which was great, because I think I needed a reminder that I serve the congregation, I lead the congregation out of my own sense of wanting to be a Christian, out of my own discipleship, right? And I need and I want the congregation's help. So we had, you know, veteran elders as well as middle school kids come to the front and say, I want to be a Christian and I want you to help me. And there was something about seeing each one, right? Seeing each person and their uniqueness and their beauty that allowed us to kind of like be free from old scripts. You know how you can have old scripts with each other after 30 years of the same congregation? you're the guy that always exasperates. You're the one who is always late and you know, whatever. But to hear somebody say their most basic desire, I want to be Christian and I want your help, set us free for a lot of things. We also had a time of confession. So during Lent of that season of Jubilee, we did confess the way we had sinned against each other by the judgmentalism, the scrutiny. Because basically, I think at that point, we were a congregation of people who judged and people who hid from people who judged. And so, again, starting with me, I offered confession before the congregation of how my leadership had become that way. Measuring, of hiding, of fearing, and how that did not allow us to become the people of God that we needed to be. So it was a wonderful journey, very messy, very, you know, uncharted. But there are ways we really did begin to see each other. You know, like remember who we truly were according to our baptisms. And at the end of the of our journey, we came together and made an affirmation, wrote an affirmation, and that was part of the way to say God had really taken us somewhere, and there was a way we could start over. So I hope that encourages.
Just by way of preparation, we're going to talk just a little bit about these just as a panel, but after that we're going to have you back in your groups, and so be thinking about that. And in your groups, there's several things that you can decide to talk about, and individuals in the group may want to go at this differently. One would just be, do you have any questions around what you're hearing from Roy and Sharon? Another one would be, is there some story that you have that you, you'd like to tell your group? Now, again, taking into consideration all the issues of how safe is that group, how vulnerable you want to be, so don't push those borders. Just do what you think is comfortable and appropriate in your group. So any questions you have for Sharon and Roy, any story about how you've learned grace in vulnerability, that's kind of the thing that I hear tying these together. And then just anything else that resonates in what you're hearing from each other or from the path. So what resonates, questions you have, or your own stories. And first of all, I told Roy and Sharon that they're free to ask each other questions, but what strikes me on what they've provided is both the incredible specificity of how God's grace enters in. These are very different stories. There's no formula here. This is on the ground, in an event, in a time, in a place that's very personal, very congregation specific, very much centered how you were pastoring in particular ways. So both the specificity, but you also both move toward what could be more general, the rituals and practices of the church. Mm-hmm. And I hear from both of you how those come together. You know, Roy, on yours, how there's this chaos and disruption and all of that, and yet you saw how it moved, how the practice of confession interrupted and changed that. And I'd love to have you fill us more in on how that was shaped, or how confession entered in. And
I think when you find yourself in the midst of conversation about what does it mean to be secure, it kind of calls out the darkness and the brokenness in that conversation and leads to that moment where you just are able to confess and to be honest within the community. And it wasn't just me, and I know the story, you know, had a lot of emphasis because it was my experience in that moment, but it was the entire congregation that was going through this. And being a mainline Methodist church, this is a big question. You know, the Florida Conference is now asking us to lock our doors before worship services. I mean, these are the conversations that are going on in churches, and for a group of us to sit around and talk about, well, how can we be more secure, how can we keep the bad people out and all these things. I mean, that's where the situation with Jonathan, who's been a participant at Cornerstone for 8 years, he is a part of our community, he's part of our family, and then he just we
he was no longer a human being in the midst of those conversations. And then eventually some point we said, we're afraid of Jonathan. He's our brother, you know, and to be able to confess our feelings about that and how distorted those things are, and then to what confession led to was the response, God's response of forgiveness and healing and a desire to reconcile that. And so we moved into this mode of reconciliation that shifted the question from how do we protect ourselves from people like Jonathan to how do we invite and welcome more people like Jonathan into our community where they feel safe, because I can't even imagine being Jonathan walking through those doors every Sunday knowing that you wrestle with this and how you might be judged and ridiculed, and how many other communities has Jonathan been pushed out of. That this is the one place where we can be an embodiment of Christ for the world. And so that idea of confession, being honest about your brokenness, tell your story. And that's why I was hoping in the story that you'd hear where I'm being not brutally honest, I was scared to death. And how that affected my perception then led to the confession of the darkness of it and moved me towards being somebody who is an embodiment of reconciliation. I love the fact that Jonathan actually came up and stood at the table now that I look back at that. Mm-hmm. Because he was not disconnecting himself from the community. If anything, I saw him in the midst of his schizophrenic fit that he was having, wanting to be whole and a part of that, even in that moment.
Yeah, it's interesting how your emphasis is really helpful on fear and how fear is part of our lives. And we can't even say, gosh, you shouldn't have been afraid. No, fear was actually a pretty appropriate response in that. And then how you ended up sorting out what is the role of fear in a faithful people.
It also forced us to confront, and in me in particularly, white privilege. I have to say, being invited to be the plenary, you know, sharing vulnerability, I don't think about vulnerability very much. I'm a powerful dude. You know? And I can take care of myself. I mean, you know, I was a church planner. They chose me because they knew that I could do it, you know, and I'm a great preacher, you know, and just my preaching is gonna bring them in. You know, this ego, I am so egocentric, and that the whole situation with Jonathan really made me aware that Jonathan's vulnerable. I'm vulnerable. I'm living in this illusion of this white privilege, power-based mentality, and I am frail, and I need Jesus.
All right. Yeah, the Spirit of God, both, and I want to connect this with Sharon, with both of you, it was both, there's reality that God's really present. And so you're working with the Spirit of God present in the situation, and you're working with, as you said, Galatians, there was a specific story that God used with your congregation at this time. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Just how did the word shape this ritual? How did the word shape your new imagination? Because this was a new imagination. You were entering a story again in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it had to do with a lot of, I think when you understand that the book of Galatians as all the social implications of being being justified by Christ, and the way that the church in Galatia was measuring, I think we got to see that's what we were doing, all the things that we were the most proud of. So that story hit us, you know, that there was one table, not two, and what that meant for us to enter in was just, you know, we wanted that.
Mm-hmm. So, wow. Yeah. And a parallel of both years, and feel free also to ask each other questions. For both of you, it led to a different kind of hospitality. Mm-hmm. Any reflections on that? I mean, that's what's, you didn't start there. Yeah. Neither of your stories started there, but both of you ended up with a different type of welcome.
One of the things that we wrote in our Jubilee affirmation was these words, in Jesus Christ we are given companions for this journey in one another. We rejoice that God has gathered us together in surprising and wonderful ways that we could not have imagined or constructed. So that was like, after this season of Jubilee, we looked at each other in a new way, and that really did allow us to, this openness to have others join us, including a lot of, lately, Spanish-speaking immigrants, both documented and undocumented, who come to our service, who don't understand English necessarily, so they have to sit through, me or, translated, but really wonderful ways that their coming to us has opened us up to more. They're being so different, us learning what makes them afraid. They go to the dentist and are afraid to fill out forms. They can't travel. Their kids are worried about President Trump and will he send you to Mexico, Mom? I heard one of these women pray at lunchtime. We're just sitting there having lunch together, and she's praying about, Lord, will you please help us pass immigration reform? That's her lunch prayer. That's not my lunch prayer, but somehow hearing her over food and being together and hearing what she wants, it opens us up, right? Not that we can fix it. I mean, that's part of the vulnerability too, is I sit there and I hear her stories about her mom is sick in Mexico and she can't be there, right? I can't fix that. But there is a way that I get to join her in her vulnerability. I get to pray with her.
I think that, one of the things we remind ourselves in the story that we continually tell each other at Cornerstone is this idea that we're about the business of allowing the walls and the barriers to come down, inviting the Holy Spirit to work in our lives in that way, where there's no longer any separation from God, from each other, from ourselves and God's creation. We say that over and over and over and over again. And we take very seriously, and almost in a way we have to confess sometimes that we get a little overboard in our hospitality. It almost becomes an idolatry of ours. We're so hospitable, we welcome everybody. That situations like Jonathan bring us into a greater conversation about what does that actually mean, that we're not really taking the time to listen to the other story. We just want to be seen as somebody who welcomes everybody in, and so I think as a congregation, the Spirit's been leading us to take more time and more patience to be with each other and to get to know each other. And that process has taken a long time, but it's a healing one, and it's one that we're enjoying now, because it's not just Jonathan's situation. We're very closely connected with the Coalition of Monthly Workers, so we've got a lot of illegal immigrant conversations going on, immigrant conversations, farm worker conversations. We have all those things are going on in the community, and it's just to know the other and to be, strive to live into that vision of being the beloved community together. And that is a very vulnerable place to be, but at the same time, a beautiful place.
Can I tell one more story?
Sure.
So this woman that I was talking about who prayed at lunch, was part of our congregation's meeting when we had an immigration forum, and we asked Mike Buddy to come and speak to us about this, and he did a marvelous job, as you would expect, and she was sitting there and she was part of it, and then that following Sunday we're at prayer time, and she had been hearing and reading in newspaper about all these ICE raids and people being deported and all of that. And at this point, this woman had not shared with our congregation that she was undocumented, but she was so afraid. And I think she also had taken to heart that we said we are one family, that she stood up that prayer time and she said, if I am deported, will you raise my children?
Mm.
And so that's a moment where she made us a better church, right? It's, we had this wonderful forum and we had these conversations, we have this vision statement and all of this stuff, but there was a way that when she stood up and asked for prayer like that and made us have to be more than our words, there was something huge for all of us. It was a gift.
It strikes me in both these how the very particular situations of God's grace that you didn't duck, for, and all the help of whoever helped you not duck, including your role, and both of them led to types of practices, which is one of the themes for the panel. Roy, you're talking about the practices that more than one person in your church had to learn about. How do you welcome people with mental instabilities or mental challenges? And that isn't something you do once. That becomes a practice that becomes a characteristic, or at least that's, I hear, your hope. And Sharon and Grace, how you actually shaped a ritual, something else Christians do, and the ritual then, but again, your goal is this isn't just a ritual, this is shaping our character in a new way. So we may get into that more later on, but just wanting to note how practices and rituals are all part of our questions around vulnerability and where it takes us. So I'm gonna give you 15 minutes in your groups. So again, name something that resonates with you. Raise any questions that you'd like to then bring to Sharon and Roy, or tell a brief story yourself. You all can do the math. If there's 8 or 9 in a group, you've got 15 minutes, you can monitor the time. If your group doesn't have very many left, feel free to disperse. If you're a person who hasn't been in a group yet, find a look around and aim toward one that isn't too large. We like to keep them in the 8 to 10 range. And I'll call you back together in about 15 minutes. You know, first, I've got a question here, got a question here. Is that gonna be it? Got a question here? Yeah, I know. Okay, so I've got 3. So what I'm going to ask you to do is... I like those too. Okay. In fact, we can start with the observation. Then the 3 that have questions, I'm going to have you state those questions all at once, just so Roy and Sharon can make notes and decide what to do. We've got another one. Okay. So we'll get all the questions out, then they can kind of decide how to sort that out and how to address it. So... So let's start with the observation.
We had a pastor share a story of an incident of serious harm that occurred because of the way a person with mental illness was handled in the congregation. And it surfaced the issue that in working at vulnerability, we nonetheless have to be very careful to not overestimate our own ability to assess what's going on and that we ought not to fail to engage with systems, expert systems, to diagnose and treat. And so it may be that we have to have either boundaries or thresholds that say to us, on the one hand, you know, we want to say this is, they may be weird, but there are weirdo, but on the other hand, when it comes to mental illness, it's not a joking matter. And there have to be those points where we get help quicker rather than slower.
Yeah.
And we can kind of romanticize vulnerability if we're not careful in ways that do great harm.
Yeah, that's part of the practices of a community. This is what Roy is getting at. They learned they needed some.
Can I respond to that?
And help. Yeah, go ahead.
We immediately called David Lawrence, which is the mental health center in Cuyahoga County. We did a lot of really hard work and connected. We have 2 really well, highly qualified counselors in our congregation. We brought them in on staff. They helped lay out parameters for us. You have to take mental illness very seriously. And if I had projected that as if it was, we were just kind of making it light, I didn't mean that in any way. It was a serious, serious, you know, issue that was occurring within our community, and we wanted to make sure that we had as much information as we could possibly gather about how to provide safe space for everybody involved in our communities.
It may just be the reminder that all of our congregations might want to know those resources before. And also, I'd say, I'd want to commend the times to call police when there's a person's in danger to themselves or others, and just to not hesitate about that, because they can give resources quickly also. So thanks. So let's get the questions, and I'll just accumulate these, and we'll see what comes out of them.
Okay, so this question is really just very much a follow-up here, because the question is, when we're asking our congregations to be radically hospitable and vulnerable, is there actually an implicit part of that invitation to be risking harm? Because even with all the best systems in place, I mean, like Roy, you had not ever had that experience with Jonathan, so there was no reason to expect that. But in fact, violence was, there was a violent act. So.
And I'll excite you to be taking notes and deciding how to handle these.
We were just a little curious on if you could fill us in a little more on the reconciliation process of Jonathan coming back into the congregation, and maybe even me personally, since it was a very personal thing that happened. Just want a little more information on that process.
Thanks.
So we had a couple. One was, did the families that threatened to not bring their children back, did you ask them or tell them, here's how we're handling it, here's why we think you're going to be safe, you know, that type of thing. And the second question was, for probably everyone, not just the panel, but how to deal with people who are very illogically disruptive in your group. You know what I mean? Like, and especially at work. like we had a situation where we had someone who was trying to pull people like away from the church into the Greek Orthodox Church or something like that, and was very divisive in the church in many conversations, and we don't have any idea if there was any mental instability involved at all. Certainly but eventually we had to ask them to move on. And so that was a difficult thing. Like, how long do you hang in with people while they're really being disruptive? And when do you cut your losses and say, we need to move on, you need to move on?
Okay, group behind you has a question.
This is a two-part question, and I'm a lot more interested in the second part, so you can take the first part, but I feel like from the perspective of a church, there's like a direction and a path that you are trying to head towards, or an idea of where you're going. How much do you deviate from that for the sake of a person? Like, how much do you warp the structure or shape of the church to accommodate people who are vulnerable? And so that is such a big question that I'm not as interested in that. But in that context, in the context of that, from the other side of things, not from the people in power, but from the vulnerable, the most vulnerable, how it seems to me like there is a big risk in saying, I need more deviation, like I need more help, I need more coming around me. And how do we as congregations like allow that to happen? Like, what do we as congregations do in order that the vulnerable people feel like they can ask for more if they need more?
Roy and Sharon, how are you on it?
I'm writing these questions down.
Yeah, I'll start with the reconciliation process question. So it was 2 weeks of not knowing where Jonathan was. And then the third week, wondering if Jonathan would ever come back, because I called the police on him. And I was worried that he just would not want to have that experience in his life ever again, which I understood. But the third week, he showed up at church again,
And I immediately went to greet him. That was just my personal response, and welcome him back, and it's good to see you. And then that week we made contact with Jonathan, and we never were able to get together during the week. Jonathan doesn't keep scheduled very well. So several of us made, you know, great, we made a kind of intentional effort when we would see Jonathan to make sure that we were with him, welcomed him, greeted him. And at the same time, we're having these conversations with David Lawrence Center and our counselors that are connected with our community about how we can continue to surround and support Jonathan with love. I wish I would have been around the L'Arche community before this happened, because everything that Stacy shared with us would have been an extremely great tool for us in dealing with the situation. We're learning by trial and error and the movement of the Spirit. And so Jonathan continued to consistently come back to church. And every time Jonathan was in church, and still to this day, where's Danny? Is Danny here? My buddy Dan. Oh, I called him out. He's not even here. you know, Danny's one of those guys who intentionally goes and welcomes and greets and sits down and talks with Jonathan every Sunday. My wife has committed to sitting next to Jonathan every Sunday, and they talk to each other probably for 15 to 30 minutes. I make sure that I go out of my way to be with Jonathan. And so it's a process. It's this journey of becoming. We don't have there's no end in this. This is going to be continually part of who we are as a community and how we're growing into this idea of becoming God's church together. And so the reconciliation continues. I'm not even sure, because I asked Jonathan where he was, and he doesn't remember anything. And so we know his cycles now, because he's been with us for 18 years. And typically it's in the spring around March, and we're just even more aware during that time. He comes to church, and he's a beautiful, wonderful, really colorful guy, and we kind of celebrate that together. And at the same time, you talk about the issue of reconciling with this process of reconciliation with Jonathan, we're also, you know, reconciling with ourselves and how we live in this relationship with each other and with Jonathan.
What about the threat of the family?
Yeah, that's the next question. Family threat. So we lost two families who haven't been back to church. But we reached out to each of those families, of course, because they sent emails and they called and said, crazy people are going to be at your church, and it's literally their language, we're not going to bring our children, because we don't want them to see that, we don't want them to feel threatened, we want them to be safe. And so we listened, and then we responded and said, you know, who we are as a community at Cornerstone is that we welcome all people, and that includes all people. So we are working together on creating an environment where Jonathan is safe, and our children are safe, and at the same time, relationships can continue to grow. A couple of families didn't want anything to do with that, and so they moved on to another Methodist church in town, which has security cameras and locks on the doors and all those things. We did put some basic measures in place. We did not have any locks on our children's ministry doors, and we did put bolt locks on the doors. Partially because we realized that our children, we have one building that we do all of our activities in, and the children kind of sit in the middle between the sanctuary and the narthex. And so whatever's going in the narthex and children's ministry, we don't have any clue when we're in worship together. And so we just did that as a precaution, made people feel a little more comfortable. We lost a few, and then there was one family that is consistently back, and because we're being very intentional and having support systems around Jonathan, they feel comfortable being there too.
I brought my friend Joanna today. She came to this conference on purpose when she saw what the topic, the gathering theme was. She really wanted to come, and she gave me permission to talk about her story. Joanna has struggled with mental illness for most of her life. When her illness is at its worst, she can't discern what's real or not. She hears things, but she's has under medication, and she's held down the same job for 24 years. She's been my friend for the whole time. There are things, you know, we enter into risky relationships whenever we open our doors, right? But there are things we gain. And I want to talk about how Joanna's been a gift to me, because I think I learned how to pray the Psalms from Joanna. You know, all those Psalms that talk about sinking in the miry in the miry pits and calling out to God for mercy. You know, whenever I had read them before, I feel like there was sort of a distance. I couldn't relate. But knowing Joanna's story and knowing what she struggles with every day, and what it means for her to come to church, to hear a word, to sing in the choir. She used to be the person who brought our communion bread every Sunday. And I think there was something about that for me that I wanted to receive from her as well, that picture of we all come broken, we all come wounded, we need a word. And when we stand together and when we hear each other's stories and say, now this is our story, right? There's a way that is a healing for all of us. So Joanna, Joanna's healing isn't this, you know, isn't the quick miracle, but it is something that we have needed. So last Lent, was it? Joanna gave a meditation in which she talked about this with our whole congregation, including our kids, some of whom she's babysat. You know, I've been in the nursery with, and we all come this way. We all come to church this way, all come with hunger, needs, brokenness, wounds. And so when we're joined together, there's a gift in something being broken open when we don't expect it. And so I'm really grateful that Joanna said today that I could tell her story and name her name, and now she's a gift for all of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other reflections on any of the questions?
How do we deal with those who have theologically disruptive in the group? We tell them to get up. I'm just kidding. I think you just have to, you know, use language of clarity of call, and that comes from the leadership of the community that you're part of, and whether you call them mission statements, or you know how you identify, or what are your virtues, what are the virtues of your community, you hold that as the standard. And when somebody gets to the point where you just realize that they're just trying to create division and separation, that they don't want to participate. We even change language. We don't use member at our church, and in the United Methodist Church, part of the Book of Disciplines, we want to bring in more members, and we can't stand that language of member. So we call everybody a full participant. And so it's that idea of participation. Are you willing to participate and contribute in the life of this community, even in the midst of your difference? Or if you're going to be diversive and try to create division and separation, then we have honest conversations with people about that all the time. It's just not be the community that God's calling you to be a part of. And I can introduce you to 142 other communities here in Naples, Florida. And a lot of them even have Trump signs on the front of their buildings, you know, that kind of thing. I guess we could answer more of those in a little bit.
If there's anything else specific on the questions, feel free to.
That might answer the first part A of your question. I just say that. We also have a thing where anybody at Cornerstone can call for a gathering. And that actually arose out of our own family dynamic in the Terry household, is that when we decided that we were going to have a child, Leslie and I said, you know, at any point, any one of us within the family group could say, I need to have a gathering. That means we meet in the living room and you tell your story or you share openly about a concern you might have. And so we carried that over to our community cornerstone. So anybody in the church can say, you know, Reverend, I really need to have a gathering. And the first place we address that is within the church leadership. So we bring it to the church leadership to discern that. If it's an issue that carries over to the greater community, then we discern that together. And then we hold a gathering at the church in the sanctuary where we give everybody space to talk and to tell their story. We're still in process of work living into that well, but we do practice that as best we can.
Just in summary, some of the things, and I'm going to give you some more group time in just a moment. Just wanted to point out the amount of focus all of these stories have around being listeners. And the amount of time it takes to listen and to pay attention to what the Spirit of God is doing. And when you think you're being disrupted by something that's not wanted, instead consider the possibility the Spirit of God's involved in the disruption. And that, again, just takes a lot of listening, and both of you modeled that. And how that moves into community discernment and whether we have adequate practices in our churches for discernment. How does that, what are your steps? How do we do that? What are those practices? What are those disciplines? The discipline of getting together and listening when that's time to do that, the discipline of attention. And relating back to some of the things that Steve Fowl commented on in the Ephesians passage of the practices of bearing each other. This takes practice, and this takes even set out norms for how do we practice this. And that it assumes failure. None of us would take any of this on if we didn't know failure's a real possibility and that we can tell the stories of our failures as much as anything else. And so back in your groups for about 5 minutes, there won't be a lot of time here. Are you hearing, are you considering as you go back, return, whether it's with a couple of individuals, whether it's with your congregation, is there some step you're supposed to take regarding what you're hearing about vulnerability, about practices, about listening, about welcoming? Are there steps or practices that you think you need to consider for the coming days as a result of what you're hearing here? So just talk in your group. Here's what I think I'm taking home. Here's a practice I want to consider. Here's one step I want to consider. And we'll check back with you in 5 minutes. Well, I get to interrupt you again. That's one of the roles of moderators in an event. And I've just asked Sharon and Roy for whatever final comments they want to make.
I want to say a word to you pastors out there. I think there's a way that we sometimes imagine that as we go forward, we get stronger and stronger. We move from strength to strength. From more competency to even greater competency, more ease. It's not that way. Like, growing up really does mean getting stripped down, more dependent, more living in our belovedness, leading out of our own hunger for God. And sometimes it gets clouded over with a whole bunch of other stuff that we feel we must do or that people expect of us. So, for me, vulnerability, and I hope for you, has been this one, it is a wonderful gift. I know we looked at it and thought, that's ironic. Vulnerability is a gift. But it actually has been, meant a lot of freedom for me, a lot of ways that scripture opens up when you see that at the center of the throne is a slaughtered lamb, or that we're called to, we're sent out by Jesus like lambs among wolves. You know, it's like those are on purpose. So our vulnerability is also on purpose. It's not just what he uses, it's what God chooses. And so enter into it deeply.
Oh. I say amen. I'll say that, you know, I mentioned the issue of acknowledging privilege. You know, when I came out of seminary, I was going to be the radical trendsetter for the Florida conference. And so I had this goal that when we have annual conference, which is our annual gathering of all Methodists in Florida. We'd always go to that gathering, and without fail, everybody would be wearing suits. And I'm like, I'm totally breaking through this. So when we went through the ordination process, to be the hip, cool young pastor coming in, I came in blue jeans and a golf shirt. And all the district superintendents came through, and they went, oh, I wish I could wear that. And the next year, everybody was wearing Dockers and golf shirts. I was like, success, you know. And so then I thought, you know, we're going to launch Cornerstone, and we're going to be casual, you know, and we're going to, you know, we're not going to buy into those small T traditions that are bound by culture and live into the capital T traditions. And then I started being surrounded by these really gifted and talented female clergy friends of mine, deacons. And I became aware that the only reason I'm able to wear blue jeans and a golf shirt to annual conference is because I'm a white male. My Haitian brothers and sisters can't do that. My Hispanic brothers and sisters and my female clergy brothers and sisters, or my female clergy. See, I'm very inclusive. I don't even think of sex. That, you know, when Lisa Lefko, who's the resident deacon at Cornerstone, stands in front of the congregation, she's being judged by her dress, by everybody in that congregation. I come up in blue jeans and very, hey, how's everybody doing? And I can get away with that. And so I think the process of encountering vulnerability, at least from my perspective, is continuing to grow and allowing others to take place and to be able to identify where that brokenness is, even if something as simple as saying dress, that I have an advantage, and then confessing that and learning how I can continue to be a better participant in this wonderful diversity of people God has created, and not being a dominant presence in that.
Well, I'm grateful to God for Sharon and Roy and how God's grace has brought to us today. Thank you.
Thank you.